I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. First published 10 years ago, the novel 13 Reasons Why was a hit among young adults, hailed for a savvy treatment of teenage suicide. It forced readers to rethink the consequences of their social interactions. It's recently been adapted for Netflix, complete with a graphic depiction of the main character's suicide, and is catching flack for glamorizing teen suicide. As difficult as the content may be, psychologist Wes Crenshaw says parents should embrace these opportunities to engage their kids in critical conversation. Today we'll look at how teens consume media and how parents can use it as a tool for discussion. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The hot new series on Netflix right now is 13 Reasons Why, that takes a hard look at teen suicide. It's very realistic, so much so that it's catching flack for glamorizing the act. Difficult stuff to be sure, but Dr. Wes Crenshaw says this is the way to open the door to some good conversations with your teen about a tough issue, because suicide is now the second leading cause of death among 15 to 19-year-olds, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is a Lawrence-based psychologist, an author who specializes in family psychology. And Wes, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
How big a topic among teens is this Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why? How big of a deal?
It's a big topic. And interestingly enough, it's a topic amongst people who haven't watched it. I have a fair number of teenagers I talk to who just will not watch it.
Because?
And, they are concerned about it being triggering. One of the things that's sort of interesting, among the many things about this that are interesting, is it's showing me how much kids are self-editing, how much they're paying attention to trigger warnings, not just their parents. I've been surprised at a number of them telling me that.
Why is Netflix interested in running this series on teen suicide? Do they think this is an altruistic kind of gesture because this is such a big issue out there?
Well, since I don't own stock in Netflix,
you can speak freely.
I can, yeah. So very clearly, if you go back to 2010, Jay Asher wrote this book, and that itself is an interesting story. He got a three-book deal out of this. And this was the only one that really hit, and it hit big. This is a book that kids I saw at the time who did not like to read, I mean the kids who aren't the readers, would read cover to cover in one setting. And there are a couple of reasons why it is, and the movie follows to a large degree the pattern of the book, even though at 13 hours it has to add an awful lot of material, and some of that's better than other. But the book is a mystery, and everybody's interested in a mystery, and you're sort of piecing – you already know what happened, and you're trying to piece together these 13 reasons why, which is the crux of a lot of the critique of the book. You know, are there these reasons why?
Reasons why
Hannah Baker commits suicide.
Yeah, okay. Teens are gravitating towards this, and they can't put the book down because...
Well, I think it's because it is a fascinating topic, and the mystery unfolds, and it gets worse and worse as the reasons mount. So Netflix, and under Selena Gomez, the actress from Disney, who I think it is true that she originally optioned this for herself, and perhaps as she has aged a little bit and doesn't quite fit that part anymore, they found another actress who does a beautiful job in the show. So I think they saw this. They not only saw this as a high drawing card, but they're now planning to go on. The show is built to have sequels, believe it or not. And they are planning a second season that picks up where some of that left off.
And I should point out in this series that each of these 13 mysterious recordings that are left behind, the woman who kills herself addresses each recording to a person who she says played a role in her tragic decision to end her own life. That's proving to be pretty controversial.
That is a big part of the controversy.
And explain the controversy.
Well, okay. So even back when we read the book, my daughter and I read this book back when she was in middle school is when it came out. And even then, as she and I were doing book club on the way to school every day, we picked up on this same concern that the book ponders the question of who is ultimately responsible for suicide. Now, the people who are, is it the individual or is it social circumstances? And that is a very deep question. I see a lot of people blowing that question off as if it's a foregone conclusion that, you know, no, there is no collective guilt for a suicide because only the individual is responsible. However, how many times have you interviewed people, including me, who have talked about bullying and talked about, you know, a few years ago that gay and lesbian and bisexual teens were at higher risks of suicide because mm-hmm. they were exposed to this? What the absolute implication of that is that there are social circumstances that increase people's propensity to commit suicide.
And this is an issue among social scientists. The level sure. of blame and all this is very much up for debate.
Sure. And instead of what I see in a lot of the critique of this film, where people are saying, oh, they're saying that, you know, we're all responsible and only that girl was responsible. And if she is allowed as a character to posthumously tell everyone they're responsible, that gives her a lot of power. That's exactly the point of the film. The film is exploring that issue. I think it does not take nearly as strong a stand as people think it does, because one of the things—
Stand on what?
On the collective responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Several times in the film, characters say she is the only one responsible for her death, but then there is this issue of these other things that were done in ranging from kind of unkind to downright violent to her.
Let me do this. I want to ask you just in a second how positive a film this is, a series this is, and what you think of it. I'm going to get our listeners to chime in here as well, because I think their opinions will range over the whole playing field here. 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So what do you think? Bottom line, has this been a positive contribution to the whole notion of teen suicide, which is such an intensely yeah. controversial issue?
I think that it is not a positive film in the sense that there is no point at which you come, even at the very final end, do you come out of this feeling pretty good. It was kind of a grueling experience to go through. I had to get it watched.
Well, it's a grueling topic.
Yeah, it is. I had to get it watched in a short amount of time, and I went home on the 2 days over which I watched it and had, you know, trouble going to sleep.
Mm.
So be aware.
Because the suicide itself, I've not seen the series. My wife's watched it. But
yeah.
I'm told that the suicide itself is very difficult to watch and get through.
One would be forgiven for skipping that scene. I think that there is a good reason it is in there, but I will tell you what, I've watched a lot of film in my day, and I would watch the storming of Normandy and Saving Private Ryan about 100 times before wow. I would watch this wow. again. It is absolutely brutal.
Okay. No one's called yet. I want to get our listeners, yep. encourage them to call, because this is such an important topic. And if you have something to say about 13 Reasons Why, we'd like to hear about it. Maybe you've discussed this with your family. You could tell us about reactions your kids have had to this. 816-235-2888 again, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Wes, how common an occurrence, let's just back up a second here, is teen suicide?
I will absolutely answer that. I do want to go back and just say I do think the existence of this film can be made a positive despite its down nature. I didn't mm-hmm. get it. I didn't really do a good job of answering the real question you were asking. So the question of how common teen suicide is, or how prevalent, is a very, very complicated one. You mentioned at the beginning of the hour it's the second leading cause. I would not dispute you. It is generally considered the third leading cause.
I was going to say, I've read third as
right.
well. Yeah.
And there is a reason why this is. You have to understand what the top three are. The first one is accidents, and 48% of all teen deaths come from an accident, mostly vehicular accidents. That is unquestionably the largest number of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
The second, typically, and unless there's been a change on the statistics this year, the 10-year, 15-year trend, the second leading cause of death amongst teens is murder. And then the third is teen suicide. And you will see some very complicated numbers when you look this up. The actual about the average number of suicides per year amongst teenagers in the United States, teenagers being people aged 12 to 18, is about 1,300. You will see the number 5,000. And that number actually, if you look closely, reflects ages up to 24. So this makes, I'm sorry to say, Steve, you and I in the demographic that is at the highest rate of suicide, men our age. Teens are at the lowest percentage likelihood of suicide by a large factor. Young adults in their 20s are not up where you and I's demographic is, but they're much higher than teenagers. So when you include that young 20s group, you elevate the number of suicides. Now, I want to be real clear. I'm not minimizing the seriousness of suicide. 1,300 is 1,300 too many, and we need to be serious about that. But to understand the scope of the problem and how prevalent it is, that those are the numbers. You have also a number of kids who make plans, have attempts that are unsuccessful, and you also have kids who don't actually finally get to that stage. So it's a broader problem than just who actually succeeds, but those are the numbers.
We're talking this morning about a very serious topic, teen suicide, the impact of Netflix's 13 Reasons Why series that so many people are talking about right now. Has this been opening the door to a good conversation in your family or not? 816-235-2888. Let's go to Chelsea from Kansas City, Missouri. Chelsea, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. So I agree with the doctor. Suicide is still a very taboo subject.
Mm-hmm.
It is something my family has dealt with, so I myself dealt with self-harm and the desire to take my own life. I thought for me one of the most compelling parts of the book, and this is a book I've read multiple times, is the chapter, the tape that focuses on when the student was stealing her notes out of her bag, and she had put a note in the community bag saying that suicide was something she was contemplating, what were kids' thoughts. And everybody felt they needed to know who it was, because then they could explore more the topic. Mm. Why was she wanting to kill herself? And how she balked at that. She felt like they didn't need to know the person or the circumstances for any other situation, but they needed it to know for suicide. And I thought the book also explored the topic very well, again, of who's ultimately responsible and then the consequences that are left behind after that person does decide to take their own life.
Chelsea,
again, it's a very taboo subject.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 29.
29, okay. And to what extent has this series and or the book opened up a conversation in your own family about suicide?
It has mostly between me and my youngest sister. So my youngest sister is 13 years younger than I am, and she also has struggled with self-harm and suicide. Her and I it was something we both struggled with. So for her and me, it's opened up a very good conversation on being able to talk about it. One of our brothers, who's 5 years older than her, it's been a positive conversation in that it's helped him understand more what her and I have both gone through. Whereas with my mom, it's actually turned her off even more. She has a very hard time coming to terms with this topic and subject, and that it's something that her own children have dealt with. So it's been a positive conversation opener for me, her, and my brother, whereas it's had a negative impact on my mom.
Yeah, I'm willing, and Chelsea, hang on the line just for a second. I really appreciate your comments. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to bet that her experience with her family probably isn't too unusual.
Well, it is not. And I think that this is what it takes to consume this book and movie, I think, is a little deeper analysis. And you see Chelsea's got it down to, you know, item by item and understands a lot of the nuance of what the book was trying to do. I think there are a lot of families who go through this. I know there are, because I don't talk about this a lot, but a major thing I do in my practice is work with the people who are the survivors in these cases. So the girlfriend, the parents, the husband, the wife, the children of persons who have committed suicide. So this is a very delicate area, and a lot of the families are real happy to have me deal with that because it's hard for them to. They don't. Mm-hmm. They would like to, and I'm not in any way disparaging that. It's just, as Chelsea says, it's very hard to think your child or husband or sister or brother would want to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. One of the problems we have in all of this that I think is worthy of us exploring is this collective guilt situation comes into play frequently after suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And as illustrated in the film, one of the most realistic aspects of the film is the charge that is led after the suicide into the schools where you have the suicide prevention talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a little bit like closing the door after the horses have left the barn.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but having worked with those kids who've lost a friend to suicide, they experience that well-intentioned intervention as blaming, as why didn't you see this coming? Now, I don't think anybody means it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the lessons of this film that's not talked about enough is the design of the characters to be unreliable reporters. Hannah is an unreliable reporter. And even the most reliable reporter in the film ends up not being a very reliable reporter.
Mm-hmm.
That's true amongst kids in high school who go through this. Their experience of what is helpful is often out of sync with what is offered. And I think that makes it hard at times to really deal with effectively.
Yeah. Chelsea, I'm sure glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You bet. Let's go to Mark from Olathe. Mark, you're on Up to Date. Our topic today, teen suicide. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is in the house. Good morning.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the movie itself. I watched the movie with my 17-year-old son, and mm-hmm. I thought it was a perfect movie to watch with a young adult because it really hit on a lot of different social issues that I was able to kind of, you know, talk to my son during the movie, during the episodes, and kind of get a feel for what was going on in his life
mm-hmm.
on a whole range of different topics.
Such as what, Mark? What kind of topics are you talking about?
You name it.
Well, you know, the movie hit on a lot of LGBT issues, how you know, kids are being treated, you know, a lot of social media issues, a lot of drug issues, you know. There's just so many different things I could say, hey, how are things going at your school? Do the kids actually do this? Mm-hmm. You know, and he was able to tell me honestly whether or not, you know, he was experiencing any of those issues or not. And I just thought it was a great opportunity to have a lot of different conversations with my kid that I ordinarily would not have had.
Yeah, Mark, I'm really, again, I'm glad you called too. What about this notion that you've read about in connection with 13 Reasons Why, that the show somehow glamorizes suicide and can possibly even be a trigger for young teens struggling with chronic depression?
Well, you know, it's really hard for me to comment on that because my kid doesn't experience any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard for me to relate to how another kid having those type of depression issues would be receptive to the movie. But my kid, we found it as purely entertainment, but definitely things that actually go on in the real world.
Right, right. Mark, thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it.
You could stop this.
Absolutely.
You can stop this film every 15 minutes. You can pause it and have a discussion about the material that just was in the previous 15 minutes.
What concerns, if any, might you have, Wes, about this notion of glamorizing suicide as a result of watching 13 Reasons Why?
Well, having talked to a lot of kids about this, they too are on both sides of this fence. I think it's a defensible position to see this as glorifying suicide, specifically because the book and movie give a great deal of power to Hannah Baker, who is using her death as a way to sort of mm-hmm. exact justice in the case. I think that's a defensible position. I think that the movie wrestles with that. I think that anybody who can sit through the actual suicide scene would not see that as glorified. It's actually quite horrible and painful physically and emotionally. So I think I can see it both ways. I think the benefits outweigh the shortcomings.
Let me get one more call here before a break. Ian from Kansas City, Missouri, who's read the book as a teen. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning. It was back in high school when it first came out, and our librarian had a book club that I was a part of that we all sat down and read it together and then discussed it. And honestly, reading it back then is probably the reason why I'm not going to watch it now.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty hard experience back then, and it really got a lot of us, even ones that were struggling with depression, to really kind of open up and talk about it. But it was still kind of a book that does stick out of my mind. And when I saw, I didn't even know they were making the show. And when I saw that it had been released, I kind of just immediately pulled back away from it.
But for you, Ian, the book helped you and your book club at school wrestle with some of these issues. Am I hearing you right?
Yes. Well, it really opened a dialogue in the book club that kind of led to some revelations from people that I hadn't really discussed their feelings on suicide, as well as, you know, their kind of suicidal ideations that they had had.
Can you recall a revelation that you still recall?
There was a female friend of mine who had actually been previously self-harming,
mm-hmm.
and hadn't really been open about that. She had been cutting on her thighs. Mm-hmm. And that really got her to kind of open up and discuss that. And I think it really helped bring something that she thought was very private out into the open and discuss it in a more safe way, because we were all discussing the same topic.
Okay. Ian, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Let's do this, Wes. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about 13 Reasons Why, and we'll talk a little bit more about parents and how they can use something like this as a window into the world of their teens. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we spoke with Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson about the history of VE Day, which is being commemorated today. We also find out why more Americans are using check cashing businesses. Find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the science behind social awkwardness, and learn how the discovery of oil on Osage Indian land in Oklahoma led to a series of bloody murders back in the 1920s. It's an incredible story. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw, who's a Lawrence-based psychologist and author who specializes in family psychology. Our topic, teen suicide, the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, which has opened up this topic to a whole lot of folks here. There was an editorial, Wes, in USA Today from a woman, Jacqueline Grimm, 18 years old, a writer, high school student who lives in Orlando, Florida. She said this, teenagers should be aware of signs of depression and suicidal thoughts, but they shouldn't think their kindness can fix anyone. That idea prevents depressed teens from getting actual help and places an enormous weight on the shoulders of the people left behind. You buy that?
Well, you hear exactly, again, that young writer is militating against the position that the book and film take, that there is this collective guilt, and that I mostly disagree with the commentator, because it's certainly true that understanding signs of mental illness are important, but that's the kind of thing I was saying kids feel bad about when you come back at them and give them a lot of signs and symptoms of suicide. One of the biggest problems with signs and symptoms of suicide is they apply to just about anyone who is undergoing psychiatric distress.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple that do stand out, and they're not frequently present, but when people start telling their friends goodbye or giving away their possessions, those are two that really don't appear in any other list of symptoms. And I think proposing that kids and even adults are good at picking those signs out when they're not trained to do so is probably not likely. Of all the cases I've worked, and there have been a lot, very rarely, maybe one or two of them, could people look back and say, oh my gosh, I see it now. So often it was really, and I mean people who were, you know, sleeping with the person who mm-hmm. committed suicide did not see these signs. Now, should we keep looking? Sure. But I think we need to be careful how much we lay on the burden of observation for those around victims.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jennifer from Prairie Village, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for Dr. Crenshaw. Many years ago, I worked on a TV movie about teen suicide, and the Network Broadcast Standards and Practices, a.k.a. the censors, were very concerned about the romanticization, the Romeo and Juliet effect portraying suicide. And they were also extremely concerned about the fact that there seems to be sort of a contagion following a suicide in a high school. There are several others that happen, and I'm very interested to hear what Dr. Crenshaw has to say about that.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer.
I think any time we create a dramatic portrayal of something, and I've written fiction, so I've had to think about that myself too, we have to take into account both the literary value of the topic and how to present it in an entertaining manner, which if you ever go to a writer's conference, they'll tell you what is the purpose of fiction. And people raise their hands and they say, oh, it's to, you know, convey profound messages in a literary style and so on. And the answer is always, it's entertaining. That is what the purpose of fiction is. Now, within that entertainment value, do you present important topics? Sure. But that's where To Kill a Mockingbird comes from, except it's really entertaining too. So finding the balance between that, making a dramatic, interesting story, and creating an environment where it looks like Romeo and Juliet, speaking of entertaining dramatic stories, is a really tricky one when it comes to suicide. But it's true when it comes to sexual assault and violence and murder also. And I think we become particularly fascinated with this idea of glorifying suicide when, in fact, any entertainment, well, my goodness, video games glorify things I don't even want to describe on the air. Pornography does too. And we probably ought to be talking about all kinds of dramatic portrayals. And as for the contagion effect, that is an area for some debate. Sometimes connections are made between suicides that aren't necessarily connected. There have been a number of suicides in the area where there were two or three in a year at a school, but there's no implied connection. Mm-hmm. Other times there may be, if there are two friends or one person who sort of opened the door for the other. I can think of a couple in particular, but sometimes we overstate that. It's because it's a very interesting thing to look at.
I hope that helps, Jennifer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, let's talk about how parents can connect with their teens over 13 Reasons Why. You're sitting there watching it on TV, Wes, and you mentioned a little while ago, actually pausing it every 15 minutes. Yeah. You could do that and glean something out of what's being portrayed here.
Yeah, I think particularly for the 15 and under crowd, this is not a film you want to just send them off to watch. You want to be aware of the material and listen to their critique of it. I've been fascinated by kids and the very rational approach they use to critiquing this material. One of the things, and I think parents can be a guide in that process, and some feel more comfortable with that than others. I think we all have to be comfortable, as we've talked about many times in the show, being involved in media and helping define it for kids. Mm-hmm. One of the most, I think, understated, there are two things about this film that I think have been so ignored and understated. The first is how much it portrays kids as struggling to interpret their world and themselves in it, and not being good at that yet. And that's really what it's about. Instead of imbuing these kids with a great glory in their knowledge and wisdom, that's not at all what the film is saying. It's saying that they are struggling. The second thing that's very relevant is parents actually appear in this film.
I was going to point that out. You were impressed by that.
Very impressed by that. It's one of the fundamental elements of young adult fiction that you learn in any conference you go to is don't have any adults be in there. The kids have to do all of it themselves. And these are imperfect adults, as the kids are in this film, but they're involved adults, and they stumble through the process and try to figure it out with the kids. Some are more supportive than others, just like in real life. Some kids, no parent ever shows up, but they're sort of implied over here. But I thought the adults in this film were unusually deep characters for a film about teens, and they were participants. And that is an illustration of how kids and their parents can relate, as we are discussing they should be.
That's interesting. Again, if our any parents out there has used 13 Reasons Why to talk with their teen or connect with their teen over some of these issues, give us a call, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, back in 1961, Wes, a guy named Newton Minow famously referred to TV as a vast wasteland, and you might be able to say now that that simply is no longer the case.
Yeah, I grew up in the era of the vast wasteland. And then came Norman Lear and All in the Family, and that began to change, and Maude. And TV is so rich now, and with so many diverse dramas that are well done, that we have to be careful consumers and smart consumers, or we'll do nothing but watch TV. The thing that's different, though, from when we were kids, we would sit at home on Sunday night and watch All in the Family. And that was very controversial. My gosh, the things Archie said and all the issues that were being talked about. And we would discuss those after a half hour, and they'd become part of our week. I can cite dialogue from those shows to this day that were important on those programs. That's not how media is consumed anymore. Media is consumed on your little pocket television. And so a parent doesn't, if they aren't looking and involved, isn't aware of a lot of the material that kids consume. And I can promise you, kids consume material on those devices that is so much worse than anything in this film that you can imagine. And parents aren't as tuned into it like they are this film. So they don't have the opportunity to help define it.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go back to some phone calls here, and let's go to Leslie from Leawood. Leslie, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Steve. I'm a psychotherapist, also specialized in teens here in Leawood.
Oh, good.
My concern is parents wait too long to get help for their kids.
Yeah.
They're not noticing the signs of depression.
True. I agree. And it, well, I don't, I'm always careful here to not just put up an ad for therapy. This is probably as good a place to put up an ad for therapy as any. It people do wait too long. They wait too long in their marriages to seek help. They wait too long for their children and for themselves. And I'm always thankful when I get a kid in well before this is an issue and I can get ahead of it. So I'm with you.
Leslie, hang on a second. I mean, what about a lot of teenage boys who aren't comfortable talking about such personal things? How do you navigate that landscape?
Well, and I bet Wes would agree with this. I think when you've got some experience working with kids, if you can just get them in the door, you can usually get them talking, because as a therapist, I'm incredibly interested in them as a human being and everything they're interested in. And they tend to open up to that.
But if it's difficult for them to speak to begin with, will they come back a second time?
Almost always.
That's interesting.
I'll add a couple things to that. The problem of the teenage boy is significant that if people go to my website, we made a funny little film. I mean, it's funny, but it's not making fun. And in it, my son plays the client, and my cat plays the therapist, mm-hmm. and they have their first session. And we struggle with this issue of boys not wanting to talk about things in therapy. Now, how to really fix that in real life, it's tricky because boys tend to be doers more than talkers. Right. And so that becomes an important part of the process, is talking with them about what they're going to do more than how they feel. But that digs into a real significant issue.
Leslie, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good day.
My cat is a good therapist, man.
Cecil from Kansas City, Missouri. Cecil, you're on Up to Date. Our topic today, teen suicide, 13 reasons why. Our guest, Dr. Wes Crenshaw.
Hey, I was an English teacher for the last 4 years, and we actually, on our sophomore independent reading list, had 13 reasons why on the book. And a lot of times it would be female students who would choose to read it, but as soon as they read it, you know, you would see them talk to their friends about it, and their friends would want to read it. And we really use the book to help really look at choices and consequences. You know, that critical kind of causal analysis forms around 17 to 20 in females. But male students, you know, they don't really get that causal analysis until their late 20s. And so I did see a lot more female students read the book. And their approach to it was much more analytical than a male student's approach to it. So I think when we're talking about audience and looking at the Netflix series, I think that's an important distinction to keep in mind. You know, there are different conversations that have to happen and logical responses versus emotional responses to what they're going to be seeing.
It's a very good point. And I just think being able to have those conversations just as you're describing it and being open to kids talking about the movie, talking about their experience in the book is just where we really need to be. And critiquing it is perfectly fine. I am not in favor of the folks who've said we need to ban it or, you know, take it off Netflix and don't let any kids watch it. Again, I would say, if you're going to try to do that, you better know what the rest of the material is they're watching. Particularly, the sexual assault scene is that's what sexual assault looks like. It doesn't look like what they see on pornography. It looks like that.
I want to squeeze one more call in here. Michelle from Overland Park, whose sister tried suicide once. Michelle, if you can go quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. She actually tried it a few different times. My comment would be that, I noticed some irregular behavior kind of early on, around 14 or so, and I didn't, you know, tell anyone. So my comment would be that no detail is too little to tell. And that, you know, if that person, you know, promises you that they will change their behavior, you know, don't listen to them, because they'll say, you know, anything they can, you know, so that, you know, you don't report it.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, thank you for calling. I'm sorry about the difficulties your sister has faced here. Yeah.
One of the things that I think is important, and it maybe bears us returning to this topic at some point, is what does work in prevention of suicide. It isn't that kids don't know signs. It is astonishing to me how much they don't tell. Mm-hmm. I have sat in sessions with kids, and they have told me these stories about kids they know are at risk, and I cannot get them to tell anyone. I have had to finally make the phone call, which is an uncomfortable situation because of certain kind of confidentialities. But kids withhold that information, and that is where the intervention needs to take place.
Well, tough topic, Wes. I appreciate you bringing these tough topics to us. I know it's sometimes hard to listen to on the radio, but important stuff for so many people. Thanks for visiting. That's Dr. Wes Crenshaw.
Take care.
It very much. The Royals are off to their worst start since 2007 after 30 games. The question now, what is the urgency factor facing the team? Greg Eklund, who talks about sports at KCUR, joins me now. And Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
An urgency factor. Does the front office recognize the urgency? And what are we talking about here?
That's the buzzword of the day, the urgency vector, the buzz phrase, because we have already seen it, actually, with the Royals, because if you go back to last year, as far as roster moves are made, the Royals' only roster move last year in the month of April was when Jerrod Dyson came off the disabled list. So to make room for him, the Royals sent down at the time Ray Fuentes, who is not even in the organization anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This year, The Royals didn't waste any time in the first 2 weeks of the season when they demoted Paolo Orlando. They demoted Matt Strom, a left-handed relief pitcher. They have since brought him back up, but they recognized that he was not helping out the team right away, so they wanted him to go back to Omaha, get himself straightened out, and then return to the team when he was ready, and he has since returned.
And so your point here is what?
My point is that by making these roster moves early this season, that they recognize that the window of opportunity is closing. And I think that's even further examined by what has taken place over the last 30 games. I don't expect the Royals to stand pat. And usually the month of May is the month when the Royals, either through front office moves or player personnel moves, but I expect something to be happening this month.
As soon as this month, saying that the fire sale you read about in the paper.
Well, I don't know about if it's going to be a fire sale. It could be maybe a coaching change, maybe not a managerial change, because I think Ned's status is solid.
Yeah.
But maybe a coaching change under Ned, maybe a player personnel move, maybe further juggling of the lineups to the point that maybe Alex Gordon won't get as many at-bats, and maybe Chesler Cuthbert will get more at-bats. I think you'll see some shifts taking place this month because they're not going to stand pat with what they're doing right now.
So you're saying even these moves could involve key players
Yes.
as early as this month, because the sense I've had is if that was to happen, it would be later on in the season.
I'm basing this on history because if you go back a few years, if you remember when George Brett was hired as the interim batting coach,
right.
That was done at the end of May. When the Royals hired Dale Swaim, who's their current hitting coach, he was hired in the month of May. That's why after this month of assessment through the month of April, the Royals have, I think with their inner office, reached some conclusions. That's why I think they'll maybe be making some changes in some regard.
Because, again, I'm not a baseball guy, but it seems like the most obvious move, maybe the easiest move early on, would be a change to that hitting coach.
And Ned Yost hinted that toward the National Fox folks who were in over the weekend doing the Fox National telecast. And then when you come off a homestand in which you're facing three Central Division opponents and you're not doing well against, you know, the best you could get is a split against the Chicago White Sox in a four-game series, this is not a fluke. This is who they are because enough time has passed this season to let them know that this is a team that has to score more runs in order for them to be competitive.
Boy, it has been discouraging watching them in the early going here. Hosmer now beginning to hit and hit pretty consistently.
But he can't do it alone.
But the rest of the team has just fallen off in such a dramatic way. And you mentioned Alex Gordon. They got this long him tied up to a long-term deal, and suddenly he has just fallen off the table.
This is one of those situations where they're going to have to address what's on the baseball field, not what's on the pay sheet. I mean, if they have to platoon between him and one of their rookies, Bonifacio, in left field in order to get more production, I think they have to bite the bullet and do what's best for them on the baseball field. I think Chesler Cuthbert is wasting away on the bench when last year, when Mike Moustakas was out with an injury, he proved he can hit and he could field at third base. But since Moustakas has returned and has shown that he's capable of doing what he had done before he got injured, Cuthbert is just sitting on the bench doing virtually nothing.
Well, a move in left field, again, involving Alex Gordon would be a big move.
It would be huge, considering that they had committed four more years to this guy. But Alex Gordon is someone who obviously is not producing right now. I thought it was the right move to move him down to the eighth spot in the lineup. I thought it should have been done sooner.
Yeah.
But now they're faced with these decisions where they've got to find something. If it's not within the team, then, you know, it may be moving somebody to shake things up a little bit.
So no question in your mind, the team that we see this year, the team next year is going to be something very different.
Very much in transition because there are a lot of potential moving parts on this team because of that pending free agent after this season, by the marquee players on the team.
You wonder why does a team go into a nosedive when it comes to batting? I guess you or no one knows the answer to that question, but man, it's been so disheartening to see this happen.
Just by what I've seen, this is my opinion. I don't think they're playing with the edge that they did a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I think in their heart they want to try hard, but I think by seeing them try as hard as they can, we're seeing them striking out at a rate that they haven't been before. That's not who they are. But they tried to, in the offseason, inject a team that had potentially more power. Well, this ballpark at home is not a ballpark built for power. It's a power... It's a team that's built more for gap power, mm-hmm. doubles and triples, because that's who they are. And they're about a team that puts the ball in play and not striking out.
Well, speaking about windows of opportunity closing here, the Chiefs and Sporting KC might fall into the same category.
Absolutely.
Greg.
Again, the buzzword, urgency. Because the Chiefs, I think, recognized that when they took a quarterback in the first round, something that they said they had been scouting since last September while the season was in progress. So we saw the Chiefs host a playoff game at home. They weren't able to win that game at home. They weren't able to advance further in the playoffs. I see the Chiefs see the handwriting on the wall. They need to know who their quarterback of the future is, and I think they went in that direction.
As you know,
there was
some school of thought that Chiefs should have gone with a player who would have impact immediately this next season, because they were a playoff team last year.
Right.
By not going in that direction, you're maybe taking the team out of the picture this next year.
They won't say that, but maybe they thought that last year was their window opportunity, and maybe now it's time to look further in the future. As far as Sporting goes...
Yeah, I was going to say Sporting.
They have 6 of their 11 regular starters around the age of 30 or older.
Wow.
So they're also in that category where they need to produce now and repeat what they had done when they won the MLS Cup a few years ago.
Okay, that's Greg Eklund, who talks about sports at KCUR. Always appreciate it, Greg. Thanks
welcome,
very
Steve.
Much. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, the science of social awkwardness. Who knew there was a science attached to that? And how a series of murders in the 1920s targeting Osage Indians helped jumpstart the FBI. It's an amazing story. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.